Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 24. We're doing a roundtable this week. I have with me James Waters, the Senior Manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware. Hi, James.
Hey, Gary.
And Brian Bukowski, the CEO of CitrusLeaf. Hey, Brian.
Greetings, Gary.
So my name is Gary Ornstein, host of the Cloud Computing Show, and we're going to jump right into the industry news. Big news this week, the EU gave their go-ahead to the Sun Oracle deal, and it is all systems go as far as Oracle is concerned. I believe that in the next couple days, we'll get the full-blown details from a five-hour webcast for those who want to participate in all that. Of course, we'll have summary for you in a couple of weeks following. But, James, you actually used to work at Sun.
Only 8 years.
What's going to happen? I mean, what's your prediction for this? The outcome of this merger?
I think that they'll probably drop a lot of volume systems on the low end. So I think that you'll see Larry Ellison exit the high volume x86 business. I used to be a development person in that group, and we were under margin pressure even back then, but we used to subsidize deals a lot with the idea of growth and future and getting market share. And I don't think he's going to want to subsidize businesses like that. So there were a lot of businesses at Sun that were kind of flat, not growing, but continually to be funded. And I think you'll see a lot of marginal businesses at Sun leave right away. And I think Oracle's the appropriate consolidator, sadly. Love all my friends at Sun, but McNeely and management never had the heart to kind of cut off the kind of deadweight businesses and just focus on the cash.
So do you think there's going to be discrimination between the hardware and software assets, or do you think it's really more a very financially focused, what's making money, what's not, let's just do the dirty deed that needs to be done?
There is a tremendous amount of money at Sun in mid-range servers and services around mid-range servers. It is an epic dynasty that they had for about a decade that has a continual cash output in terms of services and the hardware. So I would not expect to see those touch, and I would expect to see them try to actually grow the high end to expand that footprint to make money there. But I think you'll see overwhelming prejudice against Sun's middleware stack. And I think you'll see some other, you know, objects like that get dropped pretty quickly.
What about Oracle's hardware agnosticism, though? I mean, Oracle's supposed to be hardware agnostic. Now they've got a hardware stack. How's that going to shake out?
You know, I heard rumors in the early days when people were speculating that actually what Oracle wanted was the software assets, and that they were going to basically sell all the hardware assets and make enough money to pay for the acquisition and then some. We'll see in a couple days, but
I actually have a theory that this acquisition was put together pretty quickly after IBM came to the table, and it's not as planned out as you'd think. I'll give you an example. So I got a call from an investment bank after it happens. They said, James, they're telling us they can make $1 billion next year off of Java. And I laugh because Java is so fragmented. There's lots of rules. Don't get into it. But Oracle was doing back-of-the-napkin calculations to buy this company in a heartbeat. Wanted to get rid of the hardware business. This is just my inside baseball take. Wanted to get rid of the hardware business, and now they're kind of stuck with it, and they're figuring it out.
Why don't they sell it to Lenovo?
Is that like the new default? It should be like a click-down button, sell to Lenovo.
So here's my question. Sun was a real shepherd of open source under Jonathan Schwartz. We had MySQL, we had OpenOffice, we had ZFS, a cool file system, Java, probably seven other things that I can't remember. That's not what Oracle is known for. And is there a company that we think will fill those shoes?
I think that Oracle will continue doing that and will grow into the role. The Oracle on the low end has always faced pressure from MySQL, and they've always risen above it. So I think there is actually at this point a healthy dichotomy, healthy to Oracle dichotomy of there's the low end free stuff and then you jump to Oracle. And it is absolutely within their cost structure to have the poor guy that you beat up on, which is an entry level for relational databases, and then you can step up to Oracle. So I think they love the open source model, and if you look at all their product line, I mean, there's a free version of Oracle you can download, or at least close to it. I mean, everyone in some sense does freemium these days.
Yep.
So I don't see this really as any strain at all for Oracle. In fact, it's great to keep MySQL around in order to have an entry-level database that is separated.
What do you think about what they did with Sleepy Cat? Because Adrian, who can't make it this week, you know, walking down Market Street in San Francisco, told me a long tale about the annihilation of Sleepy Cat, that they basically did everything they could to freeze it, to not let anyone contribute to it, that it was very draconian. So I think there are some cautionary tales around Oracle and acquiring low-end or free
Yeah, I mean, unless they have a change of culture and a change of heart, I think your vision that you paint is certainly possible, but I don't put it in the category of likely, given the history. Now, this could be a turning point in the company, turning point in the management take, but we'll have to see.
Well, let me perhaps be a little clear. What they I think will like to do is slowly cut off the air supply. So it's nice having something down there to beat up, but you don't want it to get too powerful. Right. So what they're going to do is it'll be down there, and you know it'll be the low end thing. It'll be the entry level Oracle, but slowly it'll just get a little worse and a little worse. And
right.
You know, SleepyCat I think is a great example of a pretty awesome piece of code that has just fallen by the wayside over time. And I would see MySQL being very similar.
So death by atrophy?
But it'll take a decade. Okay. They want it to take about a decade.
Okay, we're going to start that clock now. So next up in the news, HP and Microsoft did this monstrosity of a pact, $250 million. We're going to do some cloud computing stuff together. Is this the race to the proprietary cloud?
Where can I buy it online? Where do I go sign up? Can I? Did they tell me where I can go sign up online for this cloud that they're building? What's the API?
If there's no API, it's not a cloud.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's pull out our own rules. Can I go sign up for it? Can I buy it over the internet? Can I put a credit card down at all? I'm not saying all clouds have to be that, but is there anything part of that that this? And what's the API? And I haven't seen anything that. What's HP's preferred cloud API? They haven't even said, have they, in all of this?
I don't think so. So maybe this is more the race to impress the street. Hey, we've got a major cloud initiative. We're going to cozy up with this company. But we see these little strategic formations taking shape as people need to have a major cloud story for 2010. And I guess from your opinion, it's just a story at this point.
I don't really see much meat there either. I mean, it reminds me a bit of the IBM cloud story, in which they say, well, you can license our ISOs to run on Amazon, and they call that a cloud strategy. It's like, okay, thanks. I could have uploaded those ISOs myself, guys.
I came away from the press announcement going, that's a lot of money, but not very much product that I understand. So the one thing I will say is that I think the success of like the VCE coalition has made it fashionable to do joint announcements, because some of that stack simplification is fashionable. So maybe they can get something out of it a la that, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens there. Separately, also, you know, another company that's throwing their hat into the cloud ring has been, it's VMware. James, you work at VMware. So why don't you give us a quick sort of factual synopsis of the things that came out earlier this week?
Sure. So we had a little press release that was about what we're doing with our ecosystem. So just like I just asked HP, what's the API? Where's that at? Where can I go buy it online? That's the kind of stuff that me and the team that I work on are very paranoid about and concerned about. So what we're working on is, with the press release, was integrating software development kits for Java and for Python into our API. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to extend our clouds like Terramark, BlueLock, Hosting.com directly into the developer's, you know, workbench so that he can code directly to them. So we announced with libcloud and with jclouds some direct integration. And then we also did some ISV partnerships with Cloudera, who integrated directly through the API. Once again, I'll stick to my own dog food here. And WebAppVM, who through the API is now integrated. So that's a theme for me from cloud, and you'll keep seeing it from vCloud, is, you know, how much can we add directly to our API?
Right. It definitely seems like there's this accelerator effect in cloud computing where you can have a cloud service, but then the ecosystem around it, if you can get that going in a way that's, you know, recirculating value back into the original offering, that's really how you build, you know, value and build user experience and user benefit.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only one who got sucked into my first cloud experience simply because a partner of mine said, well, we're already here, and can you just share your AMI, EC2 AMIs with us? It's just as easy as typing in this and clicking on a button, and, you know, that's, you know, the good old viral story.
Right. Yeah, it becomes the new way of consumption is, yeah, give me your API or give me your machine image that I can just load up.
So that's my cloud strategy litmus test. What's your strategy to build an ecosystem?
So another big deal, I don't know if this one was necessarily ecosystem, but this was IBM claiming that they had the largest cloud deal in delivering Lotus Live for Panasonic. And I don't know how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of users that they had there. But What did you guys make of this big fanfare?
Lotus Live?
Well, that's what I said.
What is Lotus Live? I'm sure somebody bought it somewhere.
You know, I used Lotus as a collaboration tool in the summer of 1996 at an internship with a Fortune 100 company.
And it was already passé by then.
And it was already passé. And I thought I was taking a step back from my, Telnet client.
Did you have to use F12 at any point?
But don't laugh, because there's a lot of businesses that are still tied to this platform, and it's sticky. I mean, we know how sticky Outlook can be for users and Microsoft Exchange. So I even though the name maybe has lost its appeal, it's real.
Don't underestimate IBM's ability to update older products. So when mainframe was under fire, they updated the microarchitecture to do different kernel hosting, to do some different things. So even though mainframe is an old legacy system, they made the appropriate updates to make it relevant so that businesses weren't embarrassed to use it. And if nothing else, offering Lotus as SaaS makes a lot of sense in today's buying economy.
I think the other telling thing is that the big companies are laying ground and saying this email and collaboration is going to be an important part, right? And we saw VMware do the Zimbra acquisition. Zimbra makes large-scale email server-side, client-side stuff. So this is not going away. Next thing we're going to know, there's going to be an email offering from Amazon Web Services, because Google's got one, Microsoft's got one, IBM's got one, VMware's got one. So it seems to me that that's sort of the trump card to actually ensure that you have a place all the way up the value chain for big business.
What's Brian, I saw you wince there when you talked about Amazon doing that.
Well, I don't think it's got to be something more than an email strategy, because email's been around for 30 years. If they wanted an email strategy, they would have built one. What I see much more is the coming trend of this new collaboration thing.
Okay,
and we
fair
saw
enough.
That more in the Wave announcement and all the excitement about Wave. And I'm not a huge Wave fanboy. I have my Wave account, but I find it a little clunky. But some days I go, I really wish this particular conversation was persistent. And I don't want to write an email. And there is clearly a niche in there that's waiting to be filled. And we don't have a protocol that's from the 60s like we do from email. So there's going to be this jostling together to find the right collaboration environment. I think that's what's happening more than simply an email play.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is a collaboration grab as opposed to an email grab. It's just that email is the default starting place for everybody in the way that they envision it.
Full disclosure, I'm not a Lotus user. I never have been. I just know it as an industry person, so
right.
I can't speak to their collaboration ability or what it really can.
Well, I do know that a lot of people use Lotus not only for the email but for their document sharing, and there's a lot of companies that have, I think, decades of stuff, what they consider to be their intellectual property in this Lotus collaboration suite, and moving that is a major problem. So the likelihood of an IBM improving upon it as the incumbent could well be the ticket that they have to carry them forward.
The only thing I think everyone could ding them on that announcement for, the largest cloud deployment, the first thing I thought was data center, cloud, infrastructure as a service, spanning the whole way up, and I was a little disappointed when I looked under the covers.
Yeah, it was just that they've got this large a group of users. So, hopefully we'll see more options there. I personally think that the whole email and collaboration market needs more strong players. I'm glad that Zimbra is with VMware, because I think Zimbra is one of the most underrated platforms. Just sort of, I saw it years and years ago, well before the Yahoo acquisition.
Yeah.
And the features that they had in that were really ahead of the curve, and somehow got lost underneath Yahoo.
The number one thing that I took away from it, because, again, I'm not an email expert, I'm more of an infrastructure person, was I talked to some friends at Yahoo, pretty senior, who were disappointed that they didn't have Zimbra anymore in their playbook. And that's a very small comment. I won't say much more than that. But they were like, rats, we don't have Zimbra anymore. We were using it this way or that way.
It's
strategic,
I think,
to them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. If there's any new.
So I will say, James, that a lot of people in my Twitter feed were like, this is the dumbest thing VMware has ever done. So why don't you just talk about why it might be dumb, or answer the critics? You say, you guys are infrastructure and there's this application. You shouldn't be dirtying your hands with some one crummy little application out there.
So I'm certainly not on the show as a VMware spokesperson. I'll give disclosure that I do work there. I would not want to give a company answer to that. The one thing I would say is that having volume never hurts. And that you saw a company as powerful as JP Morgan by Chase Bank because they wanted a relationship with lots and lots and lots of people to then build bigger and more higher value relationships with. And I think my personal reaction, not my company reaction, was when I saw that deal was similar to that. Companies like JP Morgan Chase have weathered big storms because they have both volume and high value relationships.
Do you ever read some of the analysis from Redmond?
No.
They did a really great piece on some of the Q&A around the VMware Zimbra acquisition. And so I'll suggest that, and we'll try to put a link in the show notes for people. You know, don't underestimate, too, that a lot of the senior executives have a background from Microsoft at VMware now. And so if there's a business that they know, it's, you know, email and collaboration. So I think there's something there, too. And let's move on to the next story. Apple prepping a cloud music service. We're going to try to have a podcast without talking about that famed new device coming this week.
What device?
What device? But they bought Lala, which is a streaming music service, which came up with some creative ways to get around licensing, to suck up all your music and then offer it back to you. And I also saw some rumors a while back about the new data center that they were building somewhere in North Carolina or that vicinity. So, you know, it is true that from a personal media perspective, I think Apple is in a position to own that the media cloud as we deal with it, certainly as far as consumers. What do you guys think?
So what's cloud about that particular announcement? What's going to be cloud about iTunes? That's what I didn't really get.
The music will be streaming from their data center to any of your devices and not...
Doesn't it already do that?
So the way I understand iTunes now, you buy music, it comes downloaded to your computer. You can sync it to your iPod, that's it. This way, wherever you are, whichever device that you have or acquire, your library will now be accessible.
Does it have an API?
It doesn't have an API.
I don't know if it has an API, Gary.
It's not cloud, dude.
Can I put WriteSkill on it? No, that's too far. But.
Moving on to the next story. Facebook is building their own data center. So here's my question. Why can't the big providers offer something economical to somebody? Where's that turning point where you say, you know what, we're so big, how many big people are we going to have building their own data centers, and how many of the folks who are sort of moving up the chain will be able to retain a service by one of the other offerings? Where's that? What are the criteria for that that flip from your guys' perspective?
I would have to say demand scale, because at a certain scale of demand, when you can tweak something, you can get a very big ROI for tweaking it. So when you're at the scale of Facebook, you do not want to potentially turn over your fundamental underlying architecture to a cloud provider. And I think we're going to talk about networking in the cloud. And that's a good example of some of the constraints that current clouds have that you just can't control. So, I mean, if someone says to you, you have to do sort of public internet discussion between all of your servers in the cloud, how the heck are you going to build Facebook on that when you want your database applications to be, I mean, database tier to be screaming fast, able to broadcast to each other and, you know, talk in any manner that they choose in an isolated fashion? I mean, it just doesn't make sense yet in the current world of cloud support something like Facebook, I don't think.
Another issue has to do with the cost structure. One of the great drivers of cloud is if you don't know how big your application is going to be 6 months out, it doesn't make sense to make a 2-year hardware commitment of buying rack space and floor space and power and machines. I think Facebook kind of knows what their load is going to be 2 years out, 3 years out, 4 years out. They're not going to be getting, you have to pay money to get that kind of flexibility. So one of my ops guys was saying that once he did cost models past about 3 racks, he could do it cheaper himself. Now, ops guys never count their own salary in. So whereas with, you know, a cloud, you actually get the ops guy's salary. They always assume that they're working for free and then they take the biggest slice. But I think that there is some benefit to saying that, you know, if you know what your expenditure is going to be, paying that directly to a hardware provider instead of giving it to a cloud provider who then takes their slice and hands it off.
Right.
You're basically capturing part of the value chain.
So my takeaway from that is twofold. One, there's a scale element, but two, there's a predictability and a forecasting element to it, that once you reach a certain stage where you have a high degree of confidence in your resource need, that's the time to make the investment.
Yeah, because by contrast, maybe a less demanding application like Azenga recently did some press with WriteScale, where they said, no, we are actually doing a big chunk of some of our social gaming on the WriteScale platform on clouds. So not to be a total hater, but maybe that's a little bit more threaded. You know, like a Zynga update might be a little bit more threaded than a Facebook update where you've got to make 50,000 database calls at once to show a live page with, you know, very immediate consistency required to do immediate comment capturing. The stuff that, that Brian is really expert at doing, is the speed stuff. Where Zynga, you know, if you just did a mafia hit on somebody and the update takes a little bit longer, you know, the person is obviously bored already. They'll wait.
Right. So let me ask you this question out in the future. Does the investment that Facebook is making in their own data center present some opportunity for somebody to come along and say, hey, we're going to do 90% of the functionality, but do it in a public cloud infrastructure? Don't have that investment? Or, you know, is there a way for somebody to play the infrastructure card against Facebook over time? Or is it a one-way street where their mass and scale and network will be so big that it, you know, can't break in?
I think mostly it's a network effect that goes in the direction of Facebook. I mean, the main weakness of Facebook is that it falls afoul of the Friendster problem and becomes ugly and not useful, or MySpace even to that extent, where people don't like it because it feels bad. So it's much more important for Facebook to continue investing in the infrastructure and creating a higher and higher bar of richness, usability, and speed that becomes harder and harder for an up-and-coming company to match.
Yeah, I would say the infrastructure is critical to Facebook. There's some good interviews out there with their engineering folks. They're pretty hardcore about it, and I think they treat speed and infrastructure as very important parts of what they're doing. And I would say that if you look at their traffic, they're starting to get approaching like on a like a path to touch Google traffic almost. So when you get to Google scale, you have your own stuff. You have your own clusters. You have your own architecture.
Yeah, and your own infrastructure software. They spend a lot of time working on a variety of projects, some of which they contribute back, some of which they keep for themselves.
And I would say their opportunity is more thinking theoretically to become a cloud provider, which they already sort of have in terms of the interface that other people can use to use their platform.
Facebook apps is sort of like that.
Yeah, so I would see them more as being commanding in the marketplace and saying, we are so big that you can come tag along with us to get superior economics against your competitors.
Mm.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that there's much of a difference between Facebook and Salesforce in terms of whether they are cloud or not. They both have a set of APIs that allow you to run inside their page. It's just that Salesforce goes around talking cloud and Facebook goes around pleasing users.
And I bet people make a lot more money off the Facebook cloud platform right now in terms of
the third-party developers.
Yes.
From Facebook versus the ones that are on as Salesforce plugins or just on the Force.com platform?
Salesforce plugins.
Okay.
I could be very wrong, but I'm guessing that I'm not.
That's my guess too.
Yeah, I would buy that. I found a couple of really cool free Salesforce plugins, which goes to show that we haven't spent money on Salesforce plugins, but it's nice to have a couple that are there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, great. That's a roundup of the news. We set a couple of topics for a roundtable discussion. One that we began in our 2009 wrap-up show, which I wanted to continue, is this idea that the cloud needs a better network. We're in this, what I'll call this twilight zone, where the network options available in the public cloud are still not where the options are in dedicated infrastructure. There's a wide gap. And specifically, I'm talking about things like the availability of multicast or certain routing protocols or the ability to have guaranteed bandwidth or a whole host of things. James, you've been thinking a lot about this. Give us your input on where we are and where we're going.
So like an epic fail loser this weekend, I asked a question on Twitter, nerdy enough, of what's your favorite OSI layer? And other than the fact that I can't believe I did it, and that like 30 people responded.
I can't believe people responded.
Yeah, I was sitting there.
Everyone would say 3. I mean, 3 is the classic, right?
Ah, but the debate was largely, I mean, so you had some people say 7, because that's a very cloud layer, right? You know, the API layer.
I was going to say, is 8 the ultimate cloud layer?
Yeah, and a lot of snark people said 9, you know.
Cloud 9.
Or 0.
Okay.
But let's just take that for a second on this question, which is that 3 gives you such a great level of abstraction and global scale, right? Like once you get to layer 3, the world is your oyster and you can really scale and be powerful. But 2 gives you speed, isolation, discovery, and communication in a completely more effective way and more controlled way. And I think one of the huge tensions in cloud right now is between layer 2 for control, speed, multicast, all that goodness, and maybe 3. I don't know what Brian thinks.
The 2 and 3 inversion, it's gone back and forth. If anyone remembers Token Ring, Token Ring was layer 2 poking its way into 3 and exposing itself and subverting the rule of 3. I mean, the reason 2 has the properties you're saying, James, of speed and guarantees has a lot to do with the implementations of layer 2. The fact that layer 2 is near the silicon, it's actually involved with the packet scheduling. I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy, but it is true in today's technology that 2 is where you get the guarantee.
Yeah.
But if you don't have an end-to-end guarantee, you don't have a guarantee. This was one of the failings of ATM, and one of the interesting points of ATM technology is that it sort of gave you this layer 2, layer 3, almost layer 7 blend, and gave you QoS along the path. And that's really what I care about as an application writer on the cloud is, hey, you know, what's my latency? I do not want latency that's 2 milliseconds. I want 0.2, and that's what my application demands, and only give me that or fail.
So I tweeted last week a Google engineering doc which came out in November, and it lays out the pods that they build to deliver services. And there's 2 big switches that connect the cluster, and then after that, I assume it's routed. But they're very explicit that the thing connecting up to, you know, with, you know, 2,000 nodes, etc., it's all switch network, and
their container pod.
Yeah, I mean these things deliver services as a unit. So they said that one search might touch 100 servers. So again, as Doug Relay likes to say, server-server traffic is the highest thing that's going on in today's architecture. And so when you have server-server traffic dominating, it starts to make that link important, and certainly when you're counting nanoseconds, etc., as Brian does, it could matter. And also just things like control and isolation and everything else that you can get at that layer.
Doesn't the availability of this type of network infrastructure, or the presentation of this level of network infrastructure to customers, go against the whole sort of shared model? I mean, is there resolution to be had? Because the whole premise of cloud computing is that you can share these resources, but at the same time, on the flip side, customers saying, I want this as a reserved amount of resource.
I think that one of the more interesting points of that is there's one thing we're never going to be able to change, one speed that's never going to change. The gigahertz will go up, the speed on the bandwidth is going to go up, everything's going to change except for the speed of light. So when you say the latency between me and you is X, it's never going to change. And the fact that you and I are in different places drives that one constant, the amount of latency between here and there. And so that's why, in fact, we need to have – this is one of the critical slots where location matters, because that's how long it takes to get a particular transaction from here to there.
Okay, but – fair enough. There's also a lot of transactions that are happening within the server side of the infrastructure. And if you have an application that's intended to scale out across a certain number of nodes and needs a storage configuration that's also scaling out across a number of nodes, I mean, the intersection between those two is a network which today, from the stereotypical cloud provider, does not give you control over those links. And my question is there, will that happen, or is that just something that we're going to see a split of applications, that those that are reliant on this kind of infrastructure and access to the networking infrastructure, guaranteed bandwidth, reservations, are going to go the private cloud route?
I think so. I mean, I think not private cloud, but what you might call enterprise cloud, where you have more of a resource awareness of where you're reserving a resource. If you have a very high-value application that needs this, why not pay, you know, 10, 15, 20%, or even 100% more to get that exact reserved resource that you need? And once that ecosystem gets big enough and you can go out and reserve within it, I mean, the idea that everything that's acquired as a cloud has to be a commodity, I think is a huge red herring. The only thing I will say, though, and this is getting to Cloud Club, which, you know, is a later topic, but when I was talking about this at Cloud Club a lot, the PaaS people were bored. So Engine Yard was bored. Oren Teich was completely bored from Heroku. A lot of people were bored because they've designed their applications that they don't care. I asked Chris Richardson from Java Foundry, do you care about this?
Right.
And he said, nah.
That was my next question, that the people who have said we're buying into public cloud and that's going to be the way we do business have redesigned or designed from scratch applications where this stuff doesn't matter. And it's really only the folks who are coming from sort of that enterprise infrastructure background of owning the end-to-end food chain or saying, hey, this is something that's important to me. But there's plenty of people doing it in the public cloud who don't need that access.
So James, I agree with you in philosophy, but my crystal ball says otherwise.
Okay.
Because I was at a video server company in the mid-90s, and it was all about optimizing switches for QoS. It was back in those days, QoS, QoS, QoS. And the reality is, everyone can just sort of take a pass on it. It's like, as long as your instance that is this big has a commensurate amount of bandwidth, a little more, a little less, you don't need to reserve. It'll sort of come along with the territory. And that's what we see in today's cloud providers. You get a certain amount of CPU, a certain amount of storage. They kind of tell you maybe how fast the storage goes, and then the networking, quote, comes for free. Reality is going to happen is there's going to be some scale there. The bigger machines are going to have, more or less networking.
Mm-hmm.
And everything gets hand-waved under the covers. And that's certainly what happened the last time that there was a QoS battle. And I got to say, it's probably going to happen again. It's really not that important. We'll end up reserving our CPUs, our memory, and our storage, and network will come along in some commensurate size.
Yeah, I think you will see a segment of the market that addresses this need, but I don't know that the entire market will address this need because it presents a big management challenge once you start giving that level of control to somebody. It removes the ability to consider it what you might call a pure virtual resource because you're starting to care about topology.
Right. Let's move on to the second topic, which is the cloud like electricity?
So there was an interesting question asked on Twitter by a person people may know as Sam Johnson, and he said, anyone who's doing cloud and not making it like electricity is doing it wrong. And this reflects back on this prior conversation. I'll just put that question out there. Maybe get Brian's response to that statement, what you think, and if it makes sense. Not to overplay the analogy analysis, but does that make sense to you philosophically, that cloud should always be like electricity, and if you deviate from that, you've made a mistake in design?
Yes, I think that's correct. We need APIs that are consistent, that work in the same ways. Otherwise, you end up with bifurcation and splitting, and nobody gets anything done. So everything that we can do, every meme we can propagate to keep those APIs in the same ballpark, their natural goal is going to be to split apart, because, well, you still got 50 hertz and 60 hertz and plugs that go this way and plugs that go that way. But our goal should be to do it as similar as possible and reuse everywhere.
Well, I think that's true at the API level. I mean, certainly when I talk about ecosystems earlier, I 100% agree with you. You have to have that ecosystem handoff. But when you plug a toaster in, you don't have to make a choice about the most optimal way of running that toaster. And if you plug a database application into a series of nodes on a cloud right now, you might need to make a series of choices about the most optimal way of running it.
Well, this is where the analogy breaks down. I think you just don't want to read too much into it.
Sure.
I mean, electricity is just, it's only got, phase and voltage.
Right.
And, what size the plug is. There's only a couple choices. A modern computer database environment has got a million choices. So, of course, it's going to be a little different. And when I'm dealing with electricity, I have to know not to run my toaster on the same circuit as my microwave. Otherwise, a fuse blows. I mean, so even in those simple systems, the user does have to be aware. So I think we just don't stretch the analogy too much.
So it's a good lightweight analogy for you, but I think the thing that I wanted to highlight is that this gets back to the network and these other feature issues, is that if clouds are going to be adding more and more features to address more and more application types, which I think they need to do, that tells me as a strategy that just sticking to completely simplified, that just stick with it's black and that's the only color you get this node and this network and this storage and shove it, is maybe not the most optimal market strategy. And that's when I start to get confused about, we'll make it just like electricity.
A strategy from the provider's perspective?
Provider perspective,
Okay.
So I'm saying, as someone who advises providers about how to go take on this market and thinks about that 24/7, the analogy graded me the wrong way, because I actually think that offering choice and differentiation, and not differentiation in the sense of incompatibility, but more application compatibility, more security, more network control might be interesting.
Well, this is the difference between the market for electricity as a consumer and as a business, right? When you're a consumer, you sort of have a standard thing, that's it. We use PG&E here in California. But when you're a business, you got options. You can buy electricity from multiple providers. You can do long-term contracts.
Right.
There is a whole nother layer of things that we would associate perhaps similarly with a detailed contract with some IT provider. So I think there, too, we can delineate that, theoretically, it'd be great if cloud computing was delivered to everybody as simply as the consumer electricity experience, but right. it's much more likely to look like the industrial electricity. I'm sure, like, you know, if you look down Silicon Valley, like Intel has a ginormous plant. I'm sure there's reams of contracts around their electricity delivery to that plant.
So maybe my offense to the whole thing is that we've even oversimplified what electricity is like. Like we have this, because I totally am agreeing with you, Gary. I think we fantasize that electricity is somehow perfect, and I don't like the godlike status of the analogy because it goes out all the time. They rate increase you. Like in my place, once I left the heat on, and they made me 4x more expensive because I went over my cap.
So. Yeah, I think there's more to it than that alone. But the design goal of electric, of making it simple and making it easy to consume, and I do think that getting back to our discussion about people designing applications for infrastructure that doesn't need a whole bunch of guarantees underneath, that's really interesting. The folks who can design a cloud application that's going to deliver the same kind of experience or the same kind of response times or the same kind of scale at much lower cost, you know, maybe it's not 100% the same, but it's close enough. That's sort of this classic low entry point market disruption moving up the food chain that makes the industry so exciting because you have newcomers who come in and sort of change the game cost-wise with the old providers.
Yeah, one thing I keep hearing from my customers is, well, we don't, our primary cost is not machines, it's not power, it's the thinking in our company that actually costs money. If we can use your product without having to bring a brain in, that was one of the good phrases, then, you know, then we'll consider it. But if we actually have to bring in someone with a brain into the room, then, you know, the cost is sky high. And so I'm going to go pro electricity on this, which is if the adoption of the cloud is so simple that you don't even need a brain, it'll take off like wildfire. If it requires a moderate-sized brain, it'll probably still take off. It'll just take more time.
So I'm outgunned here, as I was on Twitter briefly, but all I'll say is that that Facebook conversation we just had is important here because, you know, Facebook uses the same electricity as anyone else, but they've decided to build a very private, very customized data center.
I'm sure with custom electricity contracts.
Exactly. But I guess what I'm saying is that there is still a lot of gap between what you can do with just vanilla cloud computing today and every high-performance app in the world. And my hope, and the reason I stick to this, is that I hope cloud computing can become more expansive so that everyone can use it versus saying that, well, it's for a select group of SMB.
And on with that to the next section of the show, I wanted to just mention there's been a ton of meetups happening around recently. We've seen there was a Hadoop meetup just a few days ago. There's an HBase meetup tonight. There was a Chef meetup. Did you go to that one, James?
I was at Chef, the beginning of Hadoop, and Cloud Club.
Yeah, and the SF Cloud Club. So this is great for the community, and we'll just try to reprise those when they do come along. And if anyone knows of any new meetups and wants to send them into the show, please send them in to thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. Or if you want to just talk about your meetup, feel free to give us some outreach. We like to promote the discussion in as many forms as possible.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank you for sponsoring the Cloud Club from MaxiScale. We really appreciated the food. And thank you for Brian for sponsoring before. So you both have been great to San Francisco Cloud Club, and we super appreciate it.
It's all in good fun.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to jump to an interview that I conducted earlier with Peter Bauer, the CEO of Mimecast. Hi, I'm here with Peter Bauer, the CEO of Mimecast. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thanks, Gary.
And big news is you guys just secured a big round of financing, so tell us a little bit about that, and then also just a little bit of an introduction to the company as a whole for listeners who might not be aware of Mimecast.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks. We've just today announced funding through Index Ventures, which is a leading European tech investor that has backed some companies like MySQL and Skype and some other companies in our space like KVS, which is a traditional email archiving software company. We are a software as a service business, which I started with my CTO back in 2003. And we set up an internet-based service that companies integrate or connect their Exchange and Outlook infrastructures to. And we turn those Exchange and Outlook systems into much more powerful solutions by providing extended storage capabilities so that IT people don't have to worry about managing vast stores within their own networks. We also keep away all the nasties, the spam and the virus, and we provide very robust policy management across the whole email management setup. And one of the other key things that that customers are really attracted to is that if their in-house email servers fail for any reason, our cloud-based services with our integration into Outlook seamlessly emulate the Exchange environment and keep users productive while the IT staff focus on rebuilding and recovering the internal systems.
Oh, so it's actually, it can be a failover system in addition to the archiving and search and discovery capabilities.
Yeah, really what we've tried to do is remove the need for the whole ecosystem of complex products that that most IT folk have had to battle with installing around their mail infrastructures over the past years, and just round that all up into a single converged cloud-based solution that can be managed with a single console.
So let me understand this from the end user perspective. I've been an Exchange user in various companies, and you know, the couple of different issues. One is, yeah, of course, how do I search my mail if I'm at a company for 5 years? Because it's hard for me to store that. It's hard for my company to store that. But then also there's the issue of just the mailbox size problem. It sounds like what your service provides a little bit of benefit in both areas.
Yeah, I think there's the age-old problem with the amount of mail that you're allowed to have on your corporate mail system, and that's a problem for both end users as well as for the company themselves. So end users either have to do away with a lot of knowledge and record keeping that they would otherwise like to have, and the organization themselves runs some fairly substantial risks of not having key business records that would have existed inside email. And it's increasingly come into the spotlight with some of the changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, also the increase in email coming forward as evidence in court cases, and the whole e-discovery space is really hotting up, and this is making most organizations particularly interested in governing email data in a more robust way. So the pressure on storage plus the pressure to manage information and to govern it more rigorously, that's really driving quite significant adoption of email archiving technologies.
Right. So tell us a little bit more specifically about the product. If I'm a company that has an Exchange server, let's just say, for example, that I'm managing it in-house, how does the integration actually work? And what's the sequence of events of a stereotypical mail message?
Sure. Okay. And I think this is really where we've focused quite a lot in terms of our strategy around cloud computing. So I think a lot of the first wave of SaaS and cloud offerings offered sort of silos or islands of functionality that were off your network. And I think, you know, we're back in 2003 for the first 4 or 5 years of our company's evolution, we were really focused on strong, robust back-end technology. But then probably about 3 years ago, it occurred to us that the world wasn't going to drop everything they had on their own networks and move directly into a cloud environment. Mm-hmm. But they would much rather see a set of cloud solutions that they could integrate within their existing investments and extend those investments. And the key drivers there being, you know, the money they've spent, the expertise they've gathered, and the probably the most powerful factor, the inertia around end-user habit that right. couldn't really be broken, and you couldn't really shift people up. So we've developed what we call Mimecast Services for Exchange, which is a piece of software that you would install on or near your Microsoft Exchange server. And that kind of extends the store capability of Microsoft Exchange into our cloud-based, our grid filing system that provides a resilient multi-site or geographically dispersed filing system so that you have guarantees of long-term data retention in a very resilient environment. And that then ties into our technology that you'd install on Outlook, which provides an Outlook search capability where Outlook really believes it's talking to another Exchange store, albeit in the cloud. And that has some far more sophisticated search APIs than a standard Outlook search would allow you. And that means that from an end-user perspective, they can search and retain, you know, really limitless data and have sub-second response times in getting the data back.
So if I understand this correctly, whereas some technologies would say, well, go to your portal
email archiving web page in order to do this search. You guys have integrated natively with Outlook to do that?
Yes, we've integrated into Outlook as well as into Exchange, because there's some sophisticated stuff inside Exchange that you can do. And I think a lot of the cloud-based email archiving companies don't have that tight integration to Exchange, so you lose things like folder structures and different retention rules based on filing behavior of end users. So there's a fair bit of sophistication that kind of ships with that.
Yeah, I think it's very daunting the amount of emotional, physical, mental attraction that end users have to Outlook. And trying to get them to use something else can be a tumultuous process.
Yeah, so I think our philosophy has been if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
So we've kind of got really integrated our cloud technologies into those environments, so you can have the best of both worlds. You can have the rich sort of client-server traditional on-premise technologies, but those are extended and made a lot more powerful with some cloud computing technology that we provide.
Right. That's great. So what do we have to look forward to this year now that the resources are full? What can we expect from IMCAS going forward?
The coffers and the war chest are full. The troops are highly motivated. And we are directing the resources in two spaces. Firstly, we launched our North American operations in February of 2008. Mm-hmm. And we've had a great uptake in the North American market, and we've built some strong traction, particularly in the legal sector, where we've signed almost 100 U.S. law firms, and we have a great partnership with Iron Mountain Digital in North America as well. And so we're really building out our North American operation with the funds. The second area is really focusing on the R&D side of our business. And I think the future of the cloud and the SaaS space is going to be dominated by companies that have done the work to integrate with each other and build ecosystems and combinations of services that work together. So we've spent a lot of time building our core internal capability and scalability. We've then, in the last 2 years, spent a lot of time building and integrating that into the Microsoft stack, the Exchange and Outlook stack. Mm-hmm. But we're now really looking at broadening that out, because there are a vast number of different applications that companies are wanting to either consume or view the unstructured data that we hold in, or are creating more unstructured data that we could hold and archive and help integrate as part of a superset of unstructured data that companies are trying to manage.
Yeah, that sounds great. And with the, I think, renewed interest in a variety of business intelligence type of solutions, it sounds like a perfect opportunity for a number of partnerships.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Peter, where could people go if they wanted to get more information about Mimecast?
Well, the website is www.mimecast.com, and there are a number of resources there. Otherwise, emailing info@mimecast.com should also get you a cheery response from a Mimecast representative.
That sounds great. Well, thanks so much for joining us and filling us in on the news. We wish you good luck, and maybe we'll see you again another time on the show.
Wonderful. Thanks, Gary.
Okay, we're back from our interview.
So let's wrap up this show with cloud tips. These are companies, products, services, interesting things that we can pass along to listeners. I'll go first. My cloud tip is actually a feature of Salesforce.com, and I have given Salesforce.com a hard time on the UI in the past. But somebody told me about inline editing, which you have to enable for Salesforce.com, which to me is bizarre. Like, why they wouldn't make that a default feature? I don't know. But in any event, you enable inline editing, and it actually turns Salesforce.com from what I consider to be an old archaic application to something that's actually in the realm of modern web application. So my cloud tip is, if you use Salesforce.com on a regular basis, make sure you have inline editing enabled.
And a cloud tip for the geeky coding types out there, have you ever considered using Twitter as your rendezvous agent between different cloud instances? Instead of getting in bed with some proprietary API, Why not just post a little bit of machine-readable string to Twitter and then have your different machines, as they come up, read that one Twitter stream and find out where your other cloud instances are?
So have you done this?
Yes.
I believe I was told by Mr. Adrian, who is not here tonight, that Java Batch has a demo out there doing the exact same thing.
It's a cool idea.
Yeah.
Great. So we'll try to, if we can get a link to the demo, that'd be awesome.
Cool.
James, your cloud tip.
My cloud tip today was is more of like a, hey, check that out. I saw a demo today of Web App VM on the Terramark Cloud. And the coolest thing I saw about it actually was that it's starting to use like kernel level and hypervisor level introspection or examination of resource consumption to do predictive scaling, which is a little bit different from a standard, you know, what's the load on your web server that you might see on a write scale. And so you're starting to see a more holistic scaling architecture that's coming out. And I think it's kind of nerdy, right? So it's kind of interesting from a nerd ex-DTrace guy looking at that level to see it go.
DTrace, that is...
that is the ultimate nerd sauce of the universe. It's the force, man.
That is street cred right there. And on that, let's call it a wrap. Thanks to our listeners for joining us. For more information from Brian, you can go to
www.citrusleaf.net. Oh, you can leave off the www because it's actually 2010.
And Twitter, you want to share that?
BeebleCow or CitrusLeaf. CitrusLeaf.
Great. James?
So I haven't been blogging in 3 months, so the best way to catch me is on Twitter. Or
and that address?
At Twitter is WatersJames. Or if you'd like to hang out and talk cloud with me, San Francisco Cloud Club has been meeting every month and a half, and it's going well. Maybe we'll have another one soon.
And I feel obligated to include my Twitter address these days. I was asked about it on a podcast just the other day, people giving me a hard time. So that is twitter.com/Gary Orenstein. And of course, we thank everybody for listening. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. We are happy to take suggestions for topics as well as guests or companies that should be on the show. And be sure to subscribe on iTunes. You can go to iTunes and just search for thecloudcomputingshow.com, and it will come up there. Thanks again to everybody for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.